From the studios of KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jennifer Cation Armstrong is my guest. A longtime contributor to Entertainment Weekly, she's the author of Sexy Feminism, as well as a book about the Mickey Mouse Club. Her latest book is a chronicle of one of the greatest sitcoms in television history. The book is Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
You know, for some of us baby boomers, it's kind of hard to think of the period of time you write about in Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted as history. I got sort of an odd feeling. Like when you say 1970, you know, the way I think of, say, 1930. So your book made me feel, what's the word, old.
But, yeah, it does that. It's true.
But there have been enormous changes in the world since the Mary Tyler Moore Show arrived, especially the place that TV occupies in our lives. So talk a little bit about the landscape of television in 1969.
Yeah, that is. It's so interesting. I mean, there have been so many changes so quickly recently that it boggles the mind. And back then, I mean, there were only three channels, which that alone is almost impossible to grasp at this point, right?
Yeah.
It was three channels. You know, I think they may have had some big bulky remotes around some places, but mostly no. So, you know, it was very much, there were a lot of different strategies going on then that wouldn't be going on now. You know, you had to watch TV live. You had to, you know, make an appointment essentially, and, you know, especially with something like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, that was huge because they put it on Saturday night. And so people actually ended up starting to stay home on Saturday nights just to watch this show and actually CBS's entire great lineup at the time, which was Carol Burnett and Newhart and MASH and all of that good stuff. So, you know, it really was, you know, you had to think about when the show was going to be on. You had to watch it. You watched the commercials. You watched as a nation. You know, it was very different then.
Right. There was no scanning through any commercials. And if you missed something, you know, you missed it. It never, I mean, sometimes there would be repeats, but otherwise it would never be on again.
Exactly. And, you know, it's so interesting because repeats used to be a big thing then, too, because of that. So they would run reruns over the summer. And that's how people would catch up on shows. Sometimes the show would catch on, like All in the Family did that, and the Mary Tyler Moore Show to some extent as well. You know, after word got around, after people started talking about it, people would then go back and watch the reruns over the summer to sort of catch up. And, like, you know, the All in the Family in particular really had a huge bump in its second season because of that. So it's such a funny thing to think about now when we have DVRs and Hulu and On Demand and everything else. It's just, you can get anything you want anytime, and it was very, very different then.
And the networks had a lot of power because they were the ones that had the shows.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, now, you know, I could make a TV show if I wanted to and put it up on YouTube, but then it was all about these three giant networks, you know, and they really did control what we saw, and it's so funny because you would think they would be a lot less cautious, but they were also a lot more cautious because there were, you know, so much money at stake for them, and it was all about audience share at the time. The ratings wars were really heating up at the time, probably peaking almost in some ways because, you know, they were still getting used to TV. They were still figuring out how it worked in, like, the 40s and the 50s. And then throughout the 60s, it really started, the business end really started to ramp up. So they were extremely cautious when James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, the creators of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, went in to pitch The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Well, I don't know why. They had already done My Mother, the Car, as you point out in your book. You know, another thing about the networks in those days, you know, My Mother, the Car, which was like a notoriously terrible show, although I loved it. I was only 10 or 11, and I thought it was great. But is that, you know, even a show that was bad ran for the 33 episodes or whatever that they had for a season in those days. Whereas now, you know, the networks put on a show and like halfway through the first episode, they know if they're going to pull it or not.
So true. Yeah, it's true. And, you know, audience shares were so much bigger because of the three networks. Like, you know, so even that, I have no idea what the numbers were on My Mother, the Car, but I wouldn't be surprised if 10 million people were watching or something. Like, you know, I mean, it was like there were only three networks, so you could put that on, and somebody was going to at least accidentally watch it because they were going to accidentally leave the dial on that you know,
an NBC,
and not turn
sure.
it off.
Yeah.
You know, so it was weird. It was like a weird thing. Like I said, they were very cautious on the one hand, especially kind of morally, at least in 1969 still, but also, and very middle ground mainstream, kind of like they were very scared to take chances. But at the same time, they really did have a lot of power. They could kind of almost... they could make America sort of watch something just by virtue of putting it on television.
Well, the guys who wrote My Mother, the Car, who went on to create The Mary Tyler Moore Show, also were responsible for Room 222, right?
Yes, yes, which was a pretty innovative show at the time. It was about a high school, and it was a sitcom, but it had serious elements to it, and it had one of the first major African-American characters on television was the teacher on the show. So they sort of honed their signature style there. They did not really hone their signature style on My Mother, the Car. We all have to make money, you know, and they took the jobs they could at first.
The teenagers, by the way, I don't know if you're too young to know, but the teenagers on Room 222, they make the teenagers on Glee look like teenagers. I mean, there was a kid in... There was a kid in Room 222 who had to be 35 or 38 or something.
I love the so-called teenagers of television. Those are the best.
Yeah, but the only one who looked like a teenager was Karen Valentine.
Ah, yes.
And she won an Emmy for that. I remember that was a pretty good show, and I guess that was a precursor to the direction that they wanted to go.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the reason that Grant Tinker, Mary Tyler Moore's husband, who ran her production company, hired Brooks and Burns to create the show for Mary was that he had seen Room 222, and that was the direction. He thought that was sort of like innovative and modern and new, and he felt like that was what he was hoping for with Mary's show. That's exactly what he got, even though they had to fight a little bit for it. So.
I was looking in the television encyclopedia just to sort of review what Saturday night scheduling on television looked like before that night of comedy that you mentioned with All in the Family and MASH and Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart and Carol Burnett. And there weren't a lot of comedies on. They had, well, Gunsmoke, I remember, being on Saturday nights a lot for many, many years. And, you know, the comedy shows that CBS aired in the years prior to those shows that we mentioned were almost all those kind of hillbilly shows or gimmicky shows. My Favorite Martian, Mr. Ed, Petticoat Junction, Green Acres, and, of course, the Beverly Hillbillies. So how did Brooks and Burns and Grant Tinker and Mary Tyler Moore sell CBS on the idea of a show that had no hillbillies in it?
Well, it was difficult at first, because you're right, that was the big thing at the time, was the country. I don't know, it's so strange. I guess just there are cycles for everything, and there was this really strange cycle of, like, people in the country, city people in the country, you know, like, lots of that. But they did not want to do that, obviously, and they had this idea of kind of a more sophisticated show, and it was very difficult at first. They actually had wanted Mary to be divorced. Which is an oft-told story, but still always funny. They wanted Mary to play a divorced woman, and they pitched that to CBS, and CBS said absolutely under no circumstances. They had many objections to that. I actually talked to Mike Dann, who was the executive at the time, who was not keen on the idea. And he said, you know, at the time, I just thought of a divorcee as kind of a loose woman. That's what he said. Which is hilarious to me. He did admit, he's like, you know, I guess I was kind of a prude then. It was just different times. And so he didn't like the idea of that kind of sullying her image. He was also concerned. This is one of my favorite little bizarre factoids and shows you about their level of respect for their own audience at the time. He was also concerned that people would think she had divorced Dick Van Dyke, because they had been married on the Dick Van Dyke show.
Sure.
So the executives at CBS were concerned that, you know, hilariously, that people thought that was real and they would think this was real, and therefore she had divorced Dick Van Dyke. So that was that. And then also they had a research guy at the meeting who famously said that people will not watch shows about divorced people, people from New York, Jews, or people with mustaches. which I always say, like, I always sort of want to run right out and make that exact show with all of those things. Just hear
a Jewish woman with a mustache.
In New York, very important, who's divorced. And so that was kind of, it's like, what do you say to all those? There's such crazy objections that you're like, okay, I guess that's not going to work. So they kind of compromised and went with this slightly muddy backstory, to be honest, but clever in a way. They made it so that she had just been dating a guy who she supposedly put through med school. That's how they put it in the pilot episode. And the deal was that they were going to get married once he was done with med school, but then he got done with med school and still didn't want to get married, but he wanted to stay together. So she left him and went to the big city, which for her was Minneapolis, and started her life over again. So what's funny about that is that they didn't really make clear all the details. It was just this sort of, you know, vague put through med school idea. And if you think about that, it means that CBS, instead of getting a divorced woman, settled for a woman who had been living in sin. So, because there's no way she wasn't living, right? Why would you be putting a guy through med school without living with him? So they just kind of left it really vague and let viewers kind of see or not see whatever they wanted to see there. And it really worked, and this was sort of a trick they ended up doing several times with several big issues like this that they wanted to push forward on. They would kind of leave things unsaid. And I think it ended up having the strange effect of actually making the show kind of better and more interesting, too, because leaving stuff up to the imagination can always sort of, you know, enhance your experience of certain plot lines. So it was a trick they used often.
We should tell that to Lena Dunham, or whatever her name is, does girls. Leave some things to the imagination, Lena.
Yeah, there's not, we don't do so much of that anymore. I really do think, I mean, it does, talk about sounding, you know, feeling old, it's like, I know it sounds a little old-fashioned, but I really do think because of the constraints on shows, you know, I think it's true of definitely the Mary Tyler Moore Show and probably a lot of other shows and movies. Sometimes the constraints end up, you know, forcing you into creative areas you wouldn't have necessarily gone into. And it's really great. I mean, I think of something like the famous pill reference in the Mary Tyler Moore Show is not a big storyline. It's a throwaway line that they just let lie there and moved on, which is that she was with her father and her mother was leaving her father at Mary's apartment. And when she was on her way out, she said, "Don't forget to take your pill," and both the father and the daughter say, "I won't." And that was it. And that's not, the storyline was actually about Mary and her father forging a relationship, and they didn't talk about it. It wasn't like they had a big sit down about the pill later. They just let it go, and they kind of had a reaction shot, and that was it. But everybody noticed, you know, America noticed and was talking about it the next day. And that's another one of those times, and they did another one, another big groundbreaking one was when they, when Mary stayed out all night on a date. And the only way we know is that we see her in her gown, because of course Mary goes out in gowns. We see her in her gown, you know, the night before going out, and then we see her come home in the morning wearing the same gown, and that's it.
I'm sure they were just talking.
Well, it's such a funny thing, because they ended up, one of, like, kind of the driving force of the plot to some extent becomes this idea of, like, she's not going to tell anybody what happened. Like, her parents had just recently moved in nearby, and so that's the big thing, is that they noticed that she hadn't come home, and so they were bugging her about it, and she refuses to tell them. She even refuses to tell Rhoda. But there was an earlier version of the script in which she did tell Rhoda, and she told Rhoda that they did, in fact, that they stayed up all night talking. And they ended up taking that out of the script, and this is another one of those examples where, to me, it's like, by not saying it, they let viewers decide what they thought happened. And that's brilliant. That works great, because the people who wanted to see her as the quintessential good girl could just sort of go blindly about their lives, and the people who wanted to see more could assume more. So it worked out great.
If her gown was wrinkled, then they sat around talking all night, but if her gown was still pressed, she took it off and hung it up. We're talking with Jennifer Cation Armstrong, and she's written this book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. Well, you know, it's kind of the same thing in movies today. I mean, in movies you can show anything you want and do anything you want, but movies are not better than they were under the code in the 1930s and 40s when they made great classic films that they're not making anymore. So I guess that applies to television, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the thing is, of course, good things happen under both circumstances, right? Like, and I think we all, especially artists, have this urge to say, better, more freedom is better. And I love Girls, but it does also, you know, seeing the difference between these two. I always say, like, I always like to imagine Mary Richards watching Girls. I feel like she would be very shocked.
I'd like to see them. I'd like to see them film Girls in front of a live audience. How about that?
That too. I mean, that's. I think the reactions would be different from just laughter, horror, gasping, etc. Yeah, and I adore that, and I think Lena Dunham is brilliant. But you know, it's a very different set of circumstances to be working under, and I think part of, you know, people often describe the Mary Tyler Moore Show as classy. And I feel like part of it is that restraint that they showed. And it's funny, it seemed like CBS, I mean, I only have smidgens of evidence of this, but it was a general feeling I got from everything that I read and heard from the people I interviewed and saw. I always felt like that CBS was a little more protective of the Mary Tyler Moore Show than of All in the Family in that sense. Like, they were often still telling Jim and Ellen, even though they didn't have much, as the show got big, it was like there was very little interference from the network, but they would occasionally still kind of say, like, make sure you stay on the path that is right for the Mary Tyler Moore Show kind of thing, whereas they were, I mean, All in the Family could kind of do whatever it wanted, but they were still a little bit more hesitant on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and I think part of it was that sort of classy veneer, you know, it was like, it was shot kind of like a movie, it didn't have that sort of cheaper play action type feel that All in the Family had, which I'm not saying was a bad thing. I think it worked for that. It was a whole different aesthetic. It didn't even try to look real, you know. But the Mary Tyler Moore Show was different, and I think part of it was that kind of a little bit of restraint.
Well, you know, interestingly, when you watch both shows now, All in the Family and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which both were equally popular and equally daring in their day. All in the Family, because the nature of its edginess was about what was happening in the news right then, and that kind of racism that was still rampant from an earlier generation, or whatever, I'm not sure what the reason is, but All in the Family does not hold up as well. An episode of All in the Family, although there are some, you know, great episodes, if you just pick a random episode, the chances of finding one that's not all that funny is pretty easy, whereas pick a random episode of Mary Tyler Moore anytime in the seven seasons, and it's going to be funny. It's a funnier show. It holds up much better.
I agree that it holds up much better, and I've been a lifelong fan of both shows, and still watch. I get in spurts where I'll watch repeats of All in the Family sometimes. But yeah, and I have to stop after a while because it's like there's a lot of yelling. It's always like they basically are like, here's an issue, and then they yell about it for a half an hour. And again, this is not a criticism, actually. It's like just this all-out debate at top voice, and then they sort of resolve it or whatever, and then it's over. It's almost like, I always said, it kind of feels like they're dropping issues in on the bunkers every week, and there's no way all of these things could happen to the same people, right? Like, there's a swastika on their door, now there's, you know, a black family moving in, and they have this problem now, there's interracial dating now, you know, it's like, there's this issue of the week, they debate it, they settle it, the end, move on. Whereas the Mary Tyler Moore Show had this really organic, character-based kind of humor, and I think that's why it holds up, is because we love the characters and they're funny. I mean, Sue Ann Nivens, Betty White's character, is just unbelievably hilarious, no matter which decade you're
really
watching
does, She really does brighten up those later episodes after Rhoda and Phyllis.
Really, it's like you would have thought that the thing was just going to die without Rhoda and Phyllis. You really would think, oh, my God. And then they get her, and I love Georgette, too. I love Georgia Engel. They really did a wonderful job of just transitioning right into that. And, man, I keep saying this, but Betty White is just, like, if you go back and if you watch anything, just go back and watch the first episode that Betty White is in, she is transcendent. She's just she's on fire. She's so good, and she really did. She kind of brought that home, brought the sitcom home for its last couple of seasons, where I think it would have been limping along otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think so too. I mean, I think the show really took a blow when it lost Rhoda and Phyllis, because those were two great characters. And as you point out in your book, their spinoffs were not nearly as interesting as the shows that they came from. Rhoda was interesting for 8 episodes, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I was, you know, I watched Rhoda. It's weird. My entry point was almost kind of like Rhoda, because I was a little too young for the beginning of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then I sort of was watching them in syndication when I was a kid. And I definitely remember watching Rhoda, you know, in primetime live with my parents, and we always joked about Carlson the Doorman. But I love that show, and sometimes when I've watched it now, it's like there are good episodes and there's like episodes, and yeah, they had a huge problem once they got Rhoda married off, which is kind of it's interesting and indicative of the times, I think, in itself, right, that it turns out it's less interesting to watch this woman be married than it was to watch her be single. And so they ended up having to divorce her, which also is funny, since they originally could not have their divorced woman show. It was like, yay, we finally got one, I guess. But yeah, it had its moments, and certainly, I mean, everybody talked about and remembers Rhoda's wedding. But yeah, it was like it all built up to this wedding, and then it was like, bleh, you know, and they really had trouble and kind of were in and out and very spotty after that. And, you know, great, but you're right. I mean, those were such great supporting characters that I think that was partially the problem. They were so great at supporting Mary that it was tough to get them to spin off. Like, the fact that Rhoda worked at all is kind of miraculous. And the Phyllis thing was too bad, too, because I do love her as a character, and Cloris is just outrageously amazing. Every time I think about the talent on this cast, it's just incredible. And I missed the energy between Mary and Rhoda, honestly, more than anything else. It was just, I always say that I feel like for those first 4 years, the central romance of the show is actually Mary and Rhoda. Because it's just like the way they are, it's like Rhoda comes over after work every night and they have dinner together and they talk about things. And it just, I really love them together. And I missed that when she was gone.
Well, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, you wrote a very lovely piece in Entertainment Weekly a few weeks ago about Valerie Harper, and that was really a nice piece. Thanks for writing that.
Thank you. I was so glad I got to. I really was, because it was like, I hate the circumstances under which I had to write it, but I loved being able to tell the world how wonderful Valerie is.
One of the spinoffs of Mary Tyler Moore that was pretty successful, both artistically and in the ratings, was Lou Grant, which came at the end, right, it came after the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And I think that Lou Grant, you don't mention this in your book, but I think Lou Grant is a television adaptation of All the President's Men.
Yes, it's so true.
Not just because Robert Walden is in both, but because it had that feeling. I mean, it really kind of captured the newsroom look of that film.
It really did. I really enjoyed it. You know, I didn't watch it, I don't know if at all, or certainly very much, when I was a kid then. I would have been like 5 or something. I was not that into the idea of watching that show at the time. But I went back and watched it for this and really enjoyed it. Love Ed Asner. And he's such a good dramatic actor that I think one of the things that maybe this is, you know, who knows, but one of the things that I think made that spinoff so successful is that it was so different from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. It was an hour-long drama instead of a half-hour comedy, and they moved him and, you know, put him in a totally different situation where it was, it was that more of almost like a cop show, except in a newsroom. It was like story of the week. Every week was a different story. And I loved it because I used to work at newspapers at the beginning of my career, so I loved how much they captured that. I'm kind of a stickler for my newsroom storytelling. I always want all the details to be right, and they really got it right. And yeah, it was great. It was a great show, and it's actually too bad it didn't last longer.
Well, you mentioned, and I found this very interesting in your book, that it didn't last longer because of Ed Asner's political activity.
Yeah, he had some issues there. He really, really got very out, outspoken. He didn't have this going on that much during the Mary Tyler Moore Show years, but he got very, very politicized afterwards, and felt very strongly about things and spoke out about Cuba, and that did not go well at all. And really, it was a whole big mess of its own. And, you know, of course, CBS, when they canceled his show, said that it was due to low ratings, or, you know, they can say whatever they want. They don't have to ever, you know, they can cancel shows whenever they want to. But Ed maintains to this day, and I don't think his, like, most people seem to go along with this theory, that it was at least partially because he had been so outspoken about his political beliefs. So yeah, he was really bummed that it ended because of him too. He felt like, you know, he sort of accidentally ended a good thing that was going, and he felt like they had more stories to tell. But you can't muzzle Ed Asner, man. He cannot be quiet.
Well, I guess one of the great legacies of the Mary Tyler Moore Show is go out while you're on top and don't wait until. Is that show still on the air? You know.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, this was pretty new. I'm always worried about saying this was the first anything, because I always feel like somebody can probably dig something up somewhere proves me at least partially wrong. But I will say, I think it definitely was one of the first, if not the first, show to decide on its end date. That was a real innovation of, I think, Grant Tinker's more than anybody else's. He felt like he wanted to go out on top. He didn't want to have that limp along, sad thing where they, like, push you off to some horrible time slot. And then, yeah, the whole, is that show still on? Nobody wants to be, is that show still on? And he just thought, like, let's set an end date. And now so many people do this, right? Like, I mean, shows like Lost had to do it in order to figure out how to plan their whole show. But, yeah, they really were among the first to do this, and it was definitely a combination of factors, but I think it showed what foresight Grant Tinker had, that he could sort of see that things were maybe not going to be so great and that the environment for TV was changing, and he wanted to make sure, and also that they were, you know, everybody runs out of stories. You can't tell any story forever. And, I mean, I'll be honest, I think you can even feel it in the seventh season. You know, the seventh season is not my favorite season of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And I think they would have either had to massively change the show, and that's really risky, right? They would have had to really mix it up, bring in new characters, maybe, like, get her in a relationship, do something like that. Because it was just getting like, well, what is this woman really just going to keep being an associate producer in Minneapolis for the rest of her life and working for Mr. Grant? You know, so they had to kind of either mix it up or end it, and I think that they really made the right decision. And seven seasons is a great run.
And this, you've written a great book about it. It's called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. It's really a book not only about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but about television and about the 1970s in general, and Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Thank you so much for being our guest on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank Jennifer Cation Armstrong. She is the author of Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.